This installment of the ConcertCast is sponsored by Post Carbon Institute, the world's leading think tank dedicated to getting society off fossil fuels fast. PCI is proud to have James Howard Kunstler as a valued advisor, joining Richard Heinberg, Bill McKibben, Majora Carter, Rob Hopkins, and 25 other fellows in leading the transition to a more resilient world. Learn more at postcarbon.org. Hey everyone, it's Duncan Crary. You're listening to the ConcertCast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl featuring James Howard Kunstler. Jim is the author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. Quick announcement, I'm going to be taking the next 3 weeks off from this program. We will resume on August 5th. I need a little staycation. It is roasting here on the third floor of my brownstone in downtown Troy in the Northeast, where we're suffering a heat wave, especially by our standards. And I need to just stay local and keep cool, maybe sit under a tree by the river. But in the interim, I will release a listener sound-off mini-episode that contains listener comments about previous episodes. If you would like to participate in that and share your self-contained comment of 2 minutes or less about anything you've heard on this program since the beginning, please call 866-924-9499. That's toll-free in the U.S. and Canada. Or if you promise to keep your comment 2 minutes or less, you can send me an MP3 by email to letters@concertcast.com. Today's show is another enhanced podcast. This is not going to be a regular thing, but I am experimenting with the new technology. What this means is there are two versions of the show on the podcast feed. One is an MP3 audio-only file, just like normal. The other is an M4A, or also known as AAC file. What that means is there are images and photos that will play in sync while you listen. If you're listening in iTunes, there is an artwork box in the lower left-hand corner. You may need to click an arrow to reveal that. The pictures should show up on your iPod or iPad or iPhone if you're listening to the enhanced version. I've also put a QuickTime video player on the website at concertcast.com. You need QuickTime installed to play it. If you're getting really frustrated and can't figure it out, just listen to the audio-only version. Okay, for today's show, Jim and I are going to be exploring some low-income housing project towers right around the corner from me. We spent a lot of time last show exploring the beautiful 19th century urban fabric around here, so thought it was only fair to check out the seedier side of town. There are 3 9-story brick low-income housing project towers right down the street from me. One is still occupied, and it looks like they did some renovations recently to the exterior and maybe the windows, and it seems to be in fairly decent shape. I've never experienced any really bad behavior around there. But the other two towers on the other side of a highway entrance ramp to a bridge are both boarded up and abandoned and pretty scary looking, and I've heard stories about some bad behavior occurring there. So I thought Jim and I might want to check out this little corner of town and think about this whole enterprise of housing low-income people in high-density, miserable, unpleasant places, and some of the side effects of doing it that way. Now, of course, I'm sure everyone out here has seen housing projects just like these in your part of the world, so I think we can all relate to this. Enjoy the show. Okay, so Jim, we're standing here. We're only a block away from my house, but these are the projects. Now, of course, Troy's a small city, and our projects are pretty small.
They're pretty modest by the standards of other cities. They're still the projects, and they're still all about concentrating poverty, which is never a good idea, and it was something we just didn't know at the time.
So let's take a look here, Jim. On the right is the only one that's still occupied, and it's probably the nicest one in the fact that it's next to the river, and it has some grass.
It has a freeway ramp curling and wrapping around it on the approach to the bridge over the river that leads to I-787.
Yeah. Okay, so Jim, let's walk by the new one, and then we're going to go. There are a number of other housing projects on the left side. We'll tell you more about them in a minute. I want to show you the way to get to them. And they've put some effort into this one building on the right. You know, they've added some benches, and there's some places to sit, and you can look out on the river.
the site of it is a bit more fortunate than most so-called projects. You know, it is 100 feet from the river. Unfortunately, it's got this sort of freeway bridge that runs also about 100 feet in the other directions crossing the river. And probably there are plenty of windows that overlook the river, and that must be somewhat satisfying.
Plenty of parking, too.
Yeah, parking behind. And you've got I-787, which is kind of a loop road that goes around the city of Albany, around the riverfront, and then loops back up with I-87, which is the New York State Thruway, as it comes out the other side. But that's also on the other side of the river, and there must be just incessant noise that never stops.
So, Jim, over to the left, there's a little basketball court under the bridge, which is, you know, okay for cooling off.
Oh, you can play basketball in the rain.
That's right.
Bridge. A little bit gloomy, but, you know, you don't need perfect conditions to play basketball.
Okay, let's go under the road to the other side and see what happened. Okay, listeners, we're walking down the sidewalk along the edge of the ramp for the bridge, and there is a little tunnel here to the left, and I'm sure Jim will have some comments as we go through.
Oh, yeah, this is one of your typical rape-o-matic tunnels where, you know, a dark and forbidding and ambiguous place where no female in her right mind would ever come.
We have graffiti on the walls, and now...
That's their way of sort of pissing on the wall and saying, I'm the alpha dog. Oh, we've got another Uncle Sam sign at the other end here, and quite a big carved stone. Uncle Sam, nickname of Samuel Wilson of Troy, which was given near here to United States... That's not even proper grammar, is it? Was given near here to United States from markings of U.S. on military supplies in War of 1812. They left out all the definite articles, the.
Well, there's limited space on these historic markers. But I just behold this scene. We're in the sort of, we're between the spread legs of the highway that goes over the river.
Exactly. It's sort of the crotch of the freeway ramp on one side and something else on the other side here.
I mean, no human being, I think, would find this pleasant to relax in this little park-like area they've created next to the wall.
And, you know, it's significant that this is the place that they deactivated, and the buildings next to it are the ones that they decided to shut down.
So we can hear the roar of the traffic. Now, Jim, let's get a closer look here. We're looking at a completely abandoned housing project.
So this is about a 10-story megastructure broken up into about three or four different boxes, but they're all connected by these hallway things between them. Maybe they're also the elevator service shafts, I don't know. But they're in the spirit of Le Corbusier, Corbeau, Jean-Eugène Jeanneret, or Jeanneret, I think was his name. He came out of Switzerland, moved to Paris, and started to innovate the whole idea of the radiant city. He was the guy who wanted to turn the right bank of Paris into basically co-op city. With a bunch of 60-story megastructures, all identical, all deployed in geometrically absolutely regular lines and separated by supposedly by parkland. This is in the middle of the city, right? And with freeways servicing it. And he sort of conjured up what ended up being the model for the housing projects of the United States. They did very few of those things in Paris. Until actually later. But right after the Second World War, we got busy doing the Radiant City all over the USA, and it took the form of housing for the poor. And interestingly, what you get is experimentation on the poor. You know, we're taking these new untested forms of urbanism and trying them out on poor people. You know, the trouble is that rich people have the resources that if they don't like their habitation, they can just pick up and leave and buy something better or different or something else. But when you're experimenting with the poor and you stick them in these experimental urbanist structures, they can't get out. And so it ends up being rather cruel. And that's what happened. We stuck our poor in these places from the 1950s on. And beginning around the 1970s, we started to really have second thoughts. And that was when one of the great iconic demolitions occurred of the Pruitt-Igoe projects in St. Louis. They were less than 10 years old when they were blown up. But they had so quickly fallen into a terrible social disorder that the people in St. Louis felt like they had to get rid of them. And what it came down to really was this whole problem of concentrating poverty. You know, it's one thing if you're going to have poverty in your society. It's another thing if you're going to ghettoize it and concentrate it all in one very small area. And that when you do that, you tend to get really bad behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this. This is a tiny housing project, too, by all standards. But it's pretty big for my city. And I just imagine, like, each one of these windows represents another family crammed in here. There's probably a lot of unsavory characters, and it would probably seem a little bit rough.
Probably a lot of, you know, unhappiness and cruelty and bad choices being made and, you know, abuse of one kind or another and misery and also criminal activity because, you know, people who don't have jobs and livelihoods tend to get into that. Crime can pay a lot compared to having a straight job, and it becomes attractive. And pretty soon, you know, you've got a pretty substantial pocket of crime, and then you throw in an innovation in drugs like crack, and you really do start to have a problem. But, you know, I was very impressed when I went to Charleston, South Carolina a few years ago, and I was researching a chapter for one of my earlier city books. Joseph Riley, the mayor at the time, he's been the mayor for a long, long time there. He had a very aggressive police chief, too. And they got together, and they understood this equation that you can't concentrate poverty. And they made a rule down there that you couldn't have more than, I think, 6 or 8 units of subsidized housing in any given spot in the city. And it ended up being a very good decision. But that was not the decision that was made in most other American cities, where we just concentrated the poverty, and then we were living with the consequences. One of the consequences, of course, was that you got a lot of teen pregnancies and a lot of children who went on to become dysfunctional adults and to reproduce more. So, you know, it even promoted the replication of, you know, more criminal people and more dysfunctional people or more unhappy, miserable people.
Well, Jim, I've told you before that I've had troubles with my former neighbors in the past. I only live in a building that has 2 apartments in it, but it was really hairy to have problems with a neighbor in my building. I can't imagine what it would be like if I lived here and there was like
a problem with 73 neighbors, you know. This is a building that probably has maybe, you know, I don't know, 75 or 100 units in it altogether.
Right now, listeners, I mean, it's boarded up on the first floor. Earlier this winter, all the windows were open, but it's empty right now. And, it's no wonder that these places get trashed when you just cram people in here.
Oh, yeah. It raises the question, though, like what follows? And is there a plan locally to... I would think that you'd find a way to break up this block into, you know, not have it be a super block, but have it be a smaller block and maybe put something here. Now, just the presence of this ramp onto the bridge is problematical. One wonders if this will ever be really valuable real estate, residential real estate. Although, you know, given my point of view and my philosophy of where things are going, I don't imagine we're going to be driving Toyotas and Ford trucks forever. In fact, I'd say that maybe the freeway ramp may be obsolete sooner than we think. So it's hard to say how this is all going to shake out. The people who lived here in the 1870s and, you know, had the soap factory and the Uncle Sam's meatpacking plant, you know, that probably disturbed them, but they're not here anymore either. There may be another meatpacking plant here. People are going to still need to eat food. And my guess is that Troy is still going to continue to be a populated settlement. It does occupy a site on a major river, and it's a really important inland waterway, and which will probably become more important as we develop these increasing problems with trucking and fossil fuels and stuff. So, you know, I would hope that the city officials are already thinking about what this is going to be. It doesn't require huge expertise to figure out a way to make this better.
Yeah, there's talk of doing something. I just hope they don't go down the same line of thinking again, where they cram a bunch of poor people into a bunch of high rises. Let's duck around the back, Jim, because it's on my way to my place. Anyway. I'll just show you the last little bit.
One of the problems that you have when wealthy people don't inhabit the city generally, when the city is only composed of poor people and struggling people and people who are really not making it, is that they become the only constituents for the government. And so, you know, you get another round of having to find some way to subsidize housing for them, and that becomes kind of a vicious circle. But my guess is that once you empty out the vertical slum and the people who were there before disperse to other places, and you know, they won't really come back. They're gone. It's like, you know, once the people had to leave New Orleans because of the floods after Hurricane Katrina, the population of the city went down by, you know, half, I think. And a lot of those people never did come back. So it would be a mistake for us to think that cities are only for poor people and that urban only means a certain ethnic group and that our cities will never be something else. And I think that they will be something else. I think that they'll be smaller, but they'll be finer, and that, you know, all the classes of people will be inhabiting the cities, and there will also be people who are doing okay living in the cities. And if we're lucky, the people who are doing okay will feel responsible for the people who are not doing okay and maybe do a little bit more for them, a little bit better.
So, Jim, you mentioned that this idea comes from Corbeau in a strange way.
Well, the tower in a park is the basic motif.
Right, but this style of housing projects is seen throughout the rest of the world. It's been adopted as kind of a uniform place to cram poor people, right?
I think that just has a lot to do with the building technology of the period, which allows you to maximize the amount of stuff that you build on one fairly small building footprint. You know, before we had these techniques for, supporting buildings with steel skeletons, You just couldn't build a masonry building that was 10 stories high that easily. It was very, very hard. And, consequently, we hardly did it at all. The first skyscrapers in Chicago and St. Louis were masonry buildings without steel skeletons. I think the Monadnock building in Chicago was just masonry. And the walls are immensely thick in the bottom floors, and they get thinner as they go up. But you needed this tremendous strength to hold up the building. But it's the building technology of our times, and, you know, we wanted to maximize the building footprint, and, you know, but that also worked for the housing for wealthy people, because you put up a luxury condominium building on a relatively small building footprint, that is the size of the site that you're on. You put up a 60-story building full of apartments for millionaires, you're going to make a lot of money. But we're increasingly not going to be able to do that either, because we're not going to have the capital, and we probably won't have the building materials that, you know, we're going to have to go back to materials found in nature or pretty easy to make, you know, brick being one of them. And brick even might be a problem, because brick actually requires a lot of energy to make.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our email list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.